Welcome to ID the Future. This is Sarah Chaffee. Today we have on the show with us Dr. Brian Miller, who holds a degree in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in physics from Duke University. He is a technical consultant for IdeaShares, a virtual incubator dedicated to bringing innovation to the marketplace, and serves as research coordinator for the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. Today, he joins us to talk about thermodynamics of the origin of life. Thanks for coming on the show today, Dr. Miller.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what interested you in the topic of the origin of life?
Well, my area of physics was actually called complex systems physics and nonlinear dynamics. And what was really fascinating to me is as I read origin of life research, so often they would refer to concepts from my area of specialty, but typically they would refer to it in ways that weren't completely accurate. And when you look at the issue of origin of life with these thermodynamic concepts properly, what you realize is that the thermodynamic challenges are absolutely overwhelming.
Would you please explain those challenges?
Well, certainly. One of the critiques of origin of life that people often hear is that to get from, let's say, the basic building blocks of life to a cell, you have to go from a high entropy state to a low entropy state. You actually have to gain order. And that's something that's physically impossible. It's something that people argue violates what's called the second law of thermodynamics. However, when people make this argument, it's not entirely accurate, because there are cases where you have local systems which go from states of high disorder to high order, or in other words, they go to states of lower entropy. And a classic example of that is the issue of water freezing. So if you have like a cold winter day, you put out a cup of water and it'll freeze. And that's an example that would seem to violate the second law of thermodynamics, but it really doesn't. Because in that situation, what's happening is when the water freezes, it actually gives off heat, and that heat goes into the surrounding environment. And when that happens, the entropy of the surrounding environment actually increases more than the entropy decreases of the local water freezing. So what happens is the net effect is that the entropy of the universe increases. Now, people will argue that perhaps this same principle could help with the origin of life, but in reality, it can't. And the reason for that is that all systems that locally go to states of lower entropy give off heat. They're exothermic. So that means that they're going from a higher energy state to a low energy state. In fact, that's a second driving force that you see in nature, the driving tendency to go from high energy to low energy. Now, the problem is what you never see is a system that goes both from disorder to order and from low energy to high energy. That's physically impossible, yet that's exactly what has to happen in life. And for people that work in chemistry or physics, that's often referred to when you combine the two concepts as the free energy. So the free energy change combines the idea of the energy change with the entropy change, and nature always goes to a state of lower free energy, but life has to do the opposite.
Haven't researchers argued that the needed energy could come from the sun in some sort of self-organizing process like a tornado?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, that's often a loophole that people talk about, because they talk about what are called these non-equilibrium systems. So in other words, what I talk to you about is typically done in what's called equilibrium thermodynamics. And that's basically when you're dealing with temperatures that are fairly constant, the concentrations of materials and the fluid are roughly constant. So it's a fairly stable system. But the idea is that when you have these systems that are far from equilibrium, then the physics can be very different. And the argument is that these arguments collapse. And another hope is that in these systems, when you have, let's say, the sun adding lots of energy to a pond, or you have, let's say, a thermal vent at the bottom of the ocean flooding the water with superheated water or high energy chemicals, somehow that energy can be extracted and overcome the free energy barrier. Now, unfortunately, that actually doesn't work in the real world. Because when you look at these, what are called self-organizing systems or these non-equilibrium systems, everything that happens in them actually is the opposite of what you need for the origin of life. So what takes place is what nature wants to do is if you have, let's say, some materials in a liquid, it wants to cause those materials to become more dilute. So if you put salt, let's say, in water, it'll spread throughout the liquid. Also, what it tends to do is mix up chemicals. So if you look at most origin of life experiments, what you find is that if you can produce things like amino acids or lipids, they tend to be in very low concentrated forms and mixed in with a lot of other stuff. So what has to happen for Origin of Life to work is these basic building blocks of life have to purify and they have to become much more concentrated. And again, that's the opposite of what happens in these systems that are far from equilibrium.
Doesn't life overcome the free energy problem today?
That's a great question, because often what happens is that's a loophole that people want to exploit to avoid this problem of the tendency to go to lower free energy. So the basic idea is that if you're dealing with a system that's very, very far from equilibrium, it's called a non-equilibrium dissipative system. And a classic example is like a tornado. What happens is if you have these systems where energy and material is being thrown into it and energy and material is leaving, that flow of energy and material can create a process what's called self-organization. And again, that's like a funnel cloud forming a tornado. That's like if you boil water, you'll see these roll patterns in the water. And that's an example of creating what people describe as order. And the hope is that same sort of process where you have order creation and these very non-equilibrium systems can be used to justify how you can create the order of life. Now, however, that actually doesn't really work, because when you look at these non-equilibrium systems, everything taking place inside of them is actually doing the opposite of what you want to create life. So for instance, what you have is this tendency of, let's say, some material in a liquid to dilute and to mix together. So if you look at, let's say, an Origin of Life experiment, where you're bombarding, let's say, a bunch of chemicals with energy, what happens is these Origin of Life experiments always produce very dilute solutions of the building blocks of life that you want. And they're very impure. So maybe you'll produce amino acids in like a Stanley Miller experiment, or perhaps lipids, but they're very dilute and mixed up with a lot of other stuff. So what nature wants to do is to make it even more dilute and to mix it together. But what Origin of Life requires is that these very dilute mixtures actually become more concentrated. So you have to, let's say, concentrate your amino acids, and you have to purify them, which is the opposite of what nature wants to do. Also, what you find is in order for Origin of Life to work, you have to look at, let's say, your amino acids and get only one-handedness of that amino acid, because amino acids can be in both a left-handed form and a right-handed form. And the same is true, let's say, of your sugars. But nature can only use one-handed forms. And in the case of life today, it would be left-handed amino acids. But what happens is if these, let's say you had all left-handed amino acids in a mixture, what they want to do is to turn from left-handed to both left-handed and right-handed. In other words, they want to equalize. But to get the Origin of Life, you have to go in the opposite direction of what nature wants to do. And finally, even in these systems that are far from equilibrium, what happens is the systems still tend to go from high free energy to low free energy. So if you have, let's say, a chemical reaction, it's still going to go to lower free energy. So in other words, even in the examples of these systems far from equilibrium, nature is still doing the opposite of what you really need to create life. And that's why when you look at the order that's being produced in these non-equilibrium systems, like the order of a funnel cloud, that type of order is completely different from the type of order you see in life. So in these non-equilibrium systems, the self-organization you see is typically very dynamic. You've got fluids in motions, you've got a wind in motion, but the order you want in a cell is very static. You want amino acids in a very systematic fashion. You want stable structures for your cell membrane and for your molecular machines. Also, as I mentioned before, in these non-equilibrium systems, the systems want to go again from high free energy to low free energy. Well, many of the systems in life have to go from low free energy to high free energy. That's true overall and also true in the reactions that take place in the metabolism. So many of the chemical reactions in the metabolism of life go against free energy. They actually go to higher free energy. And the only way they do that is with enzymes and things like ATP. And also what you find in these non-equilibrium systems is all the order created is because of natural laws, like the Rayleigh-Benard convection, things like that. But the order you see in life is what's called specified complexity. In other words, what you have is atoms in very specific arrangements that go against what nature would want to do, but those specific arrangements achieve functional goals. So again, the order in cells is completely different from the order you see in these self-organizing systems.
And what does that tell us about intelligent design?
Well, again, that's really the key question, because when you ask the question, what happens in life today? Because certainly life can hold itself away from equilibrium. So the cell is held at a local state very far from equilibrium. And how does that happen? Well, the only way that happens is in life, you have a lot of molecular machines, things like ATP synthase, and you have information. Specifically in your enzymes, you have a very specific ordering of amino acids so that these enzymes form very specific three-dimensional shapes, and they're what drive the order that you want in a cell. So again, you have machinery and you've got information, and those are both key evidences of intelligent design. But the situation is even more extraordinary because not only do you have information in things like the ordering of amino acids, but the problem is that these amino acids or these sequences will break apart. So enzymes break apart, the proteins and cells break apart. So you have to constantly keep rebuilding them. But the problem is proteins don't self-replicate. So not only do you have the information in the, let's say, the amino acid sequences, but that information has to be copied into DNA. And the key is that the information in DNA is encoded, meaning it's not like you have one amino acid that corresponds to one molecule in DNA, but every amino acid corresponds to what's called a codon. And that's a set of three nucleotides that is what the translation looks like, kind of like Morse code. If you want to have SOS, that's dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. In the same way, every amino acid corresponds to a set of three nucleotides in DNA. Well, the problem is there's no physical way to explain how that information got encoded into DNA. Because if you were to take, let's say, a vat of amino acids, and you pour in a lot of codons, the codons that correspond to their associated amino acids are not more strongly attracted to each other than to any other amino acid. And because there's no causal connection, there's no physical connection between the two, that means the information in DNA had to be encoded separately from the information in the amino acids. Now, that's pretty extraordinary, and it gets even more extraordinary because we have no idea how the encoding took place, but we do know how the decoding works. You have ribosomes, you've got messenger RNA, you've got the tRNAs, and you've got these very special enzymes called aminoacyl tRNA synthesases. And what happens, these very special enzymes are what link together the amino acid with the corresponding codon in the tRNA. Now, the way that happens is because the aminoacyls have a very specific three-dimensional structure, which is determined by the information in the amino acid sequence, which incidentally is what's actually encoded in the DNA. So because of that, there is no possible connection between the encoding and the decoding, yet it has to use the same code. So how do you explain that? Well, what that means is that the encoding and the decoding and the information had to be there all at once, which means it had to pre-exist the existence of the cell because it had to exist before it was embodied in physical reality. But the only place that information and a code can exist outside of physical reality is in a mind, and that points very clearly to intelligent design.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Dr. Miller.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This has been ID the Future. Thank you for joining us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.